Shell V-Power Nitro Plus fuels every drive from Lake Erie to the Ohio River with a fuel like no other. Shell's premium gasoline provides engine protection even in extreme heat, like what you're experiencing today. That means more power when you need it and more performance with every drive. Shell V-Power Nitro Plus premium gasoline. More power, more performance. Chances are you're not far from a Shell station. Download the Shell app to find it. Formulation unique to Shell. With continuous use of Shell V-Power Nitro Plus premium gasoline. Shell V-Power Nitro Plus gasoline compared to lower octane minimum detergent gasoline. Actual effects and benefits may vary according to vehicle type, driving conditions, and driving style. See shell.us/more for more information.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
The start of the Lindsey Clancy trial began with Prosecutor Shannon Buckingham opening with some very key words, telling the jury it was not a debate about how the medical system treats women. It's actually a debate about how incompetent the medical system is to anyone and everyone who's unfortunate enough to have to enter through its doors. And I think the testimony that we've seen from some medical professionals in the last handful of days really solidifies that fact. And this is not an indictment on these doctors, on Dr. Tufts or anyone who was on the stand. I want to be clear on that. I view a lot of these folks as operating within the confines of a system and within the restrictions that that system implements on the people working within it. What I have a problem with watching specifically Tufts and some of the others as well, and I want to get into it, is the level of acceptance of mediocrity, of it feels like there's a level, and for years we've been saying this phrase, just do your best. And the thing is, a lot of people's bests aren't that great. You know, the best is up here. When we're just doing their best, they're down here. And when that becomes the best for everybody, well, the bar is quite low. And then if you have a system that basically doesn't support you in ways it needs to, doesn't communicate with the other, and you know, and you see how broken these systems are, and you see the inadequacies and the way it fails the patients, the ways that it does, but your response is just, well, there's not a drop down for that. and nothing more than that's just how it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. I'm telling you, awe, but don't you believe it, in the words of Bruce Hornsby. Things need to change. That's what I was shocked by, the level of complacency with the inadequacies of the system. That's what I'm going to say. Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with us, as always. Good morning, Robin. I know you've been watching this even more intently than I've been able to.
Because you do so much content.
I mean, I've been trying to absorb as much as I can. Yeah. That's been my take on what I've seen. What's been yours?
I got to highlight my... First of all, I got to apologize. Yesterday, I misspoke a bit on Patrick's current wife. I said during our episode that she was a lawyer. I had lawyer on my mind. She's actually a medical doctor.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure I correct that. And I did so on YouTube. So thank you all for correcting me on that one. I apologize for that mistake. But on this, I am so with you. I also have my own personal confirmation biases. As you all know, my daughter is also a labor and delivery nurse, so I hear a lot about the nursing industry. And plus, we have our own team here with nurses and families and whatnot. I saw such a striking difference between Tufts and everyone else. And I'm completely with you, Tony. I know a lot of people have been going at Dr. Tufts online because of her really lackluster answers, incomplete answers, her lack of depth of field, her lack of experience, all these things. But to your point, let's focus on the system that set her up to completely fail. And this is in my, even in my own town, there's a hospital system here that's under a lot of fire because of exactly this. When you start placing systems and profit above the patient, you can say all the nice words you want, but the system starts falling apart. And just as a quick comparison between the two, because here's what really struck me between the last couple of days and the majestic Kevin Reddington's cross-examination of everyone. So Tufts was able to spend, and she said, now granted, a psychiatrist is not a therapist as a primary. Mm-hmm. She's a medical doctor first and foremost.
Psychiatrists are the ones that can prescribe.
Yes.
And that's I think a lot of people don't understand that it's not the same as a therapist or a psychiatrist can prescribe the medications. A therapist is different than that.
But so can a psychiatric nurse practitioner can also prescribe. So it's kind of like nurse practitioners, but on the psychiatric side, because we got a few of these people in here. And so when you heard her, when you looked at her and you heard the cross of her, she did not have depth of field. She had been a fully licensed on her own outside of her her internship.
Residency.
Residency.
Yep.
For 1 month before she saw Lindsay.
She was green. Yeah.
Very green. And described by the organization as an expert in the field of this, of women's health, of postpartum depression. And granted, she said during the residency, she saw like 40 or 50 cases of this, but had seen none as fully licensed. Without support, she did everything as she testified solo. There was no, you know, if you're dealing with a first patient that is like this, you would think that there would be teachers, mentors, guides, someone to bounce things off of. And she kept deferring back to, well, the systems drop-down menu, didn't ask for this. She's describing the intake process. She's describing about 13 minutes. You can hear the insurance companies saying, you can only do this, you can only do this, you can only do this. And that's her. Now let's compare it to, again, we're going on these first impressions, Julie Paul. Mm-hmm. Julie Paul was the labor and delivery expert who then became a midwife. And I also believe, again, if I get it wrong, I apologize. I think she's also a psychiatric nurse as well. Oh my gosh. So her intake, 90 minutes, 30 minutes with the nurse first to get all the vitals and everything. Then 1 hour with Julie herself. And you know how she found her? From what I heard, I recognize the last name is Clancy. I think Lindsay's mother had a friend that put her in contact.
Mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law. That's right. Mother-in-law. And then she calls her on the phone on the weekend. Mm-hmm. The nurse, you know, Paul called Lindsay on the weekend, asked if she had permission. She called her. And so Lindsay then had her own personal cell phone. She was constantly checking in. You saw depth of field. You saw compassion. You saw the years and years of reps of doing these things. And when she's talking about the medications, when she's talking about the therapy, when she's talking about her discussions, she's going back and forth. I mean, she was able to field questions. She was able to answer things. And you could just sense because the congruency between she never had a deer in the headlights. Mm-hmm. She never had to justify anything. She never had to deflect and say it was a system that set up this way, or there's no drop down menu here, or I was high, or so it was just a vast difference we saw between the nurses, the nurse practitioners, even the psychiatric nurse practitioners, and the psychiatrist with very little to no experience in anything in life. And you saw the systems, is what I'm saying. You saw the systems in vast contrast, no congruency, no collaboration, and the result was catastrophic.
I'm just looking into the future, and I'm guessing there will be a 40-some-year-old, 50-some-year-old version of Dr. Tufts that will look back on this and just cringe, if she's not already, going, oh my God, my response was a drop-down menu? Like, that's my reasoning? That's just what – it's like you're speaking these things out loud. like the filter or the idea, like maybe this isn't the adequate answer. Maybe there are some things here that you could point to and go here and phrase it a certain way of here's the restrictions I'm working within.
Right.
Maybe there's not a lot of room for conjecture because there really isn't a lot of times on the stand. So I got to play with that too and have some understanding and grace there. But I don't think anyone would have shut her up if she would have answered in a way of, here's how the restrictions are to answer your question. But again, she's on the line too civilly. So anything she says can and will be used against her there too. So you don't necessarily, she's not necessarily in a situation where she's going to be inspired to throw her office under the bus, or the infrastructure to which she operates under the bus that license her. There's a lot of motivating factors for the answers that she gave, but other than just being really young and really green, I didn't look at her as like she's some nefarious person. She's just
she's best not of what she had, and she didn't have anything.
She's starting out, and it's like if I was assigned her, I'd be like, I need a new one. Like, I need somebody with some reps in this. I mean, it's just. But everybody's got to start somewhere, I guess.
And there's a business aspect of this that I understand and get. I have a couple of good friends of mine that are actually medical doctors.
Yeah.
One is an orthopedic surgeon, and he's got multiple doctors in his practice. And what is striking when I became friends with him and talked to him and watch him do what he does, he has depth of field of his business. He's not a doctor that is just an employee. It's since it's his name that is being used for profit, he feels very accountable to how he's being represented. And so Dr. Tufts couldn't even respond to not knowing what's said about her on the website. At least she said she didn't. So in other words, she was just merely in her, as she was portraying it, I'm a pawn in the system of my organization.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, that organization is really saying who they are because of you, your title and position. We're getting clients in because of you. So you better have some damn well vesting in what we're saying about you. In other words, and this is where I think the system also fails, official and unofficial. Where was the teacher, mentors, and guides saying, hey, look, and listen, you're a brand new psychiatrist in our practice that we're going to use your name, we're going to put you on the Facebook page, we're going to put you out there on the website, and we're going to market our business based on you. I mean, even with a book coming out, I got another thing coming out in a couple of days that we'll announce. Yeah. I have a marketing team. You have publicists. You have people that work with you that say, are you comfortable with this? Are you comfortable with this?
Yeah.
She deflected the entire thing as if she's completely oblivious about anything except her drop-down menu. She had such a narrow scope, you know. And so where the hell, again, system, the entire system is completely, it's like she's selling hot dogs, man. I mean, and she's set up in a hot dog stand and so just sell these hot dogs price.
You're exactly right. I mean, it's what it felt like. It felt like we weren't talking about someone's mental health. It felt like it was, well, the drop-down menu says I can't add mustard to the order.
Yeah.
Well, the bottle's right there. Why didn't you pour some on? But it's not on the drop-down menu.
It's not on the menu.
It's not on the drop-down. I can't do it. It's a level of accepted bureaucracy and accepted blocks, accepted roadblocks that are purely purely conscious. They're not really there. They're inserted there by suggestion, and you're operating as if it's a true brick wall and that you have no autonomy. But that's how a lot of these systems want you to work. That's why there's so much of this, because people like that thrive in these environments, because these sort of systems only want people like this. And if you're different, if you're unique, well, those are the ones that have the independent private practices that don't take a lot of insurance, because a lot of insurance doesn't want to deal with that and actual help. They want to deal with the cattle calls, move them through. And I feel like she's young. She's in the beginnings of her career.
Was in
a system. Was. Yeah. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the woman, but holy shit. Either it's time for a career change and this just is not the world for you. Mm-hmm. Or you need to seriously question, the scope of your dedication to this practice, because I don't believe your heart's in it. Okay with this level of care that you're giving, because it's not adequate to what is needed. When you're talking about mental health, you're not selling hot dogs. The drop down's not for mustard, and I think that's a key thing.
I agree. You know, and well, I'm sorry to pile on, but one more note on this thing too is one of the things that medical doctors are is they're scientists as well. They do a lot of research. It is a lot of challenging doctrine. It's a lot of understanding algorithms, process, you know, and there are established protocols that are put in place because of research and experimentation and cause and effect theories, hypotheses, all these things. They use the scientific method with what they do based on established protocols, which requires a lot of curiosity and challenging things that don't make sense. They ask questions, and like you just said. And so the lack of questioning of systems, which is, in my estimation, from what I understand from the doctors I know, is what you do as a doctor. If something's not working effectively, you question the system, because that's what scientists do. You're trying to disprove yourself all the time, because if it's not working, you question and interrogate that system. And it did not happen here whatsoever.
Well, ever. When the system is designed to keep people moving through, to keep getting billable hours and to keep getting billable things to send to the insurance company, that's you lose some of that. And I'm not insinuating that they were trying to like screw her over. Or it's such a broken ecosystem. And this is 1,000% an indictment on it. This is the world needs to see this. If people are like, oh, this is some one-off. No, this is how the medical system works pretty much all the time. This is a snapshot on a Tuesday. And unfortunately, Lindsay Clancy was in such a horrific state mentally that a Tuesday ended up costing the lives of her three children. I want to go to some of the comments that I've seen on this online and just kind of throw them out there. No right or wrong, all conjecture. And if you got thoughts on it, be sure to drop them in the comment section. Here's one of them. It says, hold on, the doctor who ran her hospital stay gets asked how many women with postpartum psychosis she's ever treated, and the answer is none, not one in a whole career. And she's the one who cleared Lindsay to go home. Does that single answer decide the case, or am I letting it do too much work? Well, she hadn't been in the field all that long, so long career, not really there. And postpartum psychosis, you can theoretically and very likely, your odds are actually there of spending a whole career and never once treating someone with postpartum psychosis, because it is that rare. Now, postpartum depression is a different thing. That's something you would normally see. But even her response to that was, maybe a couple. There was no confidence to that answer, too. I was kind of like, you don't even know if you've seen that, do you? The odds are there might be. But it's just, yeah. So, I mean, what's your thoughts there? I mean, we're entrusting people to make judgment calls on psychiatric situations when, again, I can understand maybe never seeing it, but it feels like there wasn't even an understanding of it.
Yeah, I saw this in my own career, and I think many people see it in their career too, and it's hard to see when you're in your 20s or early 30s, and that is she didn't know what she didn't know. She thought she knew everything. All you heard her say was all the experience she had as an intern, and it just, that's not real world. When, again, I know it's kind of apples and oranges, but it's kind of the same thing. In my field of work, when I first had assigned my squad in New York City, you were assigned to the lowest cases possible because you don't have the reps yet to actually go against a known intelligence officer working on behalf of a foreign government. That went to the big guys. That went to the guys with 20, 25 years experience. And even though I remember saying to myself, I got this, I can do this, what they would do is, and the cases, in all cases in successful organizations, is like, all right, you got this, you got the energy and you got the chutzpah. All right, I'll tell you what you can do. You can be the co-case on this. Or I'll tell you what, we'll put you out lead. But we're going to assign you, you're a Jedi Master, to ride bumper cars for you. So they'll be your guardrails as you're moving down the course together. She was completely solo, at least from her description, solo on, granted, and this is what I mean. This was a big case, but she didn't recognize it as a big case. This was a big, Lindsay was in a lot of crisis, and she was being as transparent as possible, but, and again, I'm not an expert, so I don't know what she should have saw or didn't saw. All I know is that Dr. Tufts did not see it. Yeah. Could someone more experienced, like the nurse practitioner, all of them saw more there. They all were so much more vested personally in her. And it's not, and I know it takes bandwidth. I know it breaks boundaries of people's personal and professional life. Okay, it happens sometimes. I mean, hell, I mean, when you're a I remember in the Marine Corps once, remember a senior officer told us once, goes, you know, you have jobs and you have professions. Job is something you do 9 to 5 and you leave it and you go home at the end of the day, you never think of it again. A profession is something you live every minute, every day, and you think about it 24/7. Welcome to our world, right? As I'm thinking about Tony in my mind on this all the time.
Yeah.
You know, but you live it. And you could feel the nurses in her life living it, doing the best they could, maintaining boundaries. And the doctor was a job. I mean, the psychiatrist, it was a job for her. And she was checking off the boxes, and it was profound difference there. I don't know what the right answer on that one is. I'm just telling you, you could see it, you could sense it. And as we saw, the results are catastrophic.
Here's another one, and I got some thoughts on it too. Her psychiatrist saw her on January 23rd, the day before, and testified she thought Lindsay was just depressed. So either that doctor missed something enormous or there was nothing to miss. I don't know which one scares me more. Which one is it? And this is, I think, the crux of this whole case. In terms of the public's reaction to it, why people are going after Patrick and saying they think he did it, why no one can wrap their mind around this idea that we can't see a psychotic person or someone in active psychosis. I got to say that correctly. Someone in active psychosis. And no, you can't always. And that is, it's simple. It's so many things. We always talk about this. So many things are just... It's a simple answer. You can't always see that. They're going to look normal. They can figure out directions. They can tell you to pick up food. They can tell you to pick up Miralax. They can actively tell a doctor that they're just depressed, that they're not thinking of horrible things. And they may have various motivations to do that, whether they're embarrassed, shameful, or literally not feeling that way at all at that moment in time. So they're not going to express that. But then 30 minutes later, they might feel that way. But they're not considering that that is something they should be answering yes to in that moment. Not because they want to hide it, but because that's what's going on when you're in a state of psychosis. Nothing is adding up. Nothing is making sense. But it's all making sense to you. The discombobulation of everything makes total sense to you the way you're seeing it. But somebody on the outside looking in is not going to see that. And they're only as good as what you're able to share with them. But a person in active psychosis is not in a state to share accurately.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. They're not in a place to share accurately. So you're not going to get accurate information. And the best decisions that can be made for that person might not necessarily be made because they don't have all the information. And you know, are there ways to dig deeper and try to get to it? Yeah, sure. But, you know, there's got to be grace there, too, for a provider. You only can dig so much and dig so far if someone's not going to reveal what might be behind their mask or even realize they're wearing a mask. I feel like there's a lot of indictment going on of us as a society and our fear that this is around us, that people are capable of this. And because of that fear, we don't want to accept it. So we're trying to find 50 other things of what to blame other than the simplicity of, you don't know when someone's in psychosis and horrible things can happen. And they do.
You know, I was thinking a lot when you're talking about, and you're right, recognizing psychosis from the outside in, I mean, it was missed by everyone, right? So it's a very hard thing. There are outwardly signs of it. Again, I'm not a licensed clinician, just from the research we see. But here's what I saw the experienced nurse practitioners, psychiatric practitioners, and the midwife picking up on that the psychiatrist didn't pick up on, at least as described during the testimony, and that is an arc of behavior. And here's the arc of behavior that Lindsay kept saying every single time. Every single time. No sleep, no sleep, no sleep, no sleep.
Yeah.
In other words, they kept trying medications. And every time Lindsay was seeing any one of these practitioners, there was no change. Nothing seemed to be working. Nothing seemed to get better. So what the nurse practitioners were saying was they kept close hands on to the best they could because they saw a flat arc. In other words, nothing was getting better. But they couldn't see if it was getting worse or not. But they know the effects of lack of sleep. They know the effects of lack of eating. They know the effects of all these medications, and they're seeing something going wrong. In other words, there's something still going on. Something's not working. Something, because I remember I've had friends I've talked to for years that, you know, I always use this as an analogy with a friend of mine that just might need some therapy or a counselor or something. If I have a good couple conversations with you, if it's not something more than that that you need to go see someone professional. And so that's what's happening here. They're giving her the counseling. They're giving her all these different medication to try, and nothing seems to be working. And so the fact that that wasn't working meant they kept their closer hands and closer eyes on what was going on. And psychiatrist didn't seem to, just was dismissive of the fact that there's no change. Nothing's changing. Nothing's getting better. Which if you take all the data points that lack of sleep and all these other symptoms are giving her, as you know, it was kerosene on that psychosis, which ramped it up.
Well, and here's the thing. When she goes to the doctor, one of the big things she's presenting and telling everybody is lack of sleep. So she's being treated then for lack of sleep. And her lack of sleep, she's anxious about not being able to sleep. So she's being treated for anxiety and depression and her lack of sleep. That's what they're looking at on the surface. And it's not getting much deeper than that. Meanwhile, she's actually suffering from postpartum psychosis and bipolar. Very different things than treating anxiety and depression and bipolar. In fact, you take medications for anxiety and depression, it's actually going to worsen the symptoms of lack of sleep and is going to aggravate that 10 times, which is exactly what happened. And as those symptoms continued to be aggravated, they kept getting worse. It just sent her on a further downward spiral as she continued to have the bipolar and the postpartum depression. She's being medicated for the wrong thing. Her anxieties on the surface level of the lack of sleep keep getting worse and keep getting exacerbated. And she keeps getting more meds for the wrong thing, which then basically turned into destruction. I mean, that is what happened here. If we're playing follow the pills, it was a misdiagnosis. It was treating the wrong thing. And then the psychology of what was going on in her mind was this fear of lack of sleep, which when you have lack of sleep can lead to 1,000 other things. So it was a shit show. And I've seen this. I've seen the lack of sleep. I've seen the fear of the lack of sleep with people on these very specific medications. I've seen the anxiety. I've seen all of this. I've watched it. And that lack of sleep end of it fucks with people to no end. And then you add the mixture of the meds and the pre-existing conditions, and holy shit, this is what can happen.
You know, what another thing that struck me, and I don't know the answer to this. I'm putting it out there as kind of a question. You know, again, questioning the system. So when you listen to both the psychiatrist and the other people giving their testimony, the nurses, I didn't understand this because I've never been on these kind of meds, but a lot of them take 4 to 6 weeks for the full effect to take effect. So if you're on a mix of a lot of different cocktails of these meds and you're seeing the reactions, the negative reactions they're having, and you're hearing her, at what point does inpatient get triggered instead of outpatient?
Well, I mean, getting into inpatient is we've seen that a few times of how difficult that is. You need the resources. You need to be approved to be.
I know, but you see the point, though?
I mean, you would think. I agree.
Like, what's the trigger? If this wasn't the trigger so she couldn't. So as I understood the testimony, the side effects of the meds after 4 to 6 days was too much on a lot of these things. So they said, all right, we'll try something else since you can't, because you got to get through the side effects for the first couple days, if not a little bit longer, before the full effect in 4 to 6 weeks of the meds kick in, you know? And so that's what also caused the jumping around of them. I mean,
they weren't even doing that. I mean, I'm not a medical professional by any means, but I know enough to understand that you can't go on and off these meds like TikTok.
Yeah,
like
I know. And that's what I'm saying. It's like, the inpatient.
That's how they were being doled out. And one of the reasonings from one of the providers was, well, if the patient doesn't believe in the medications, it doesn't tend to work well. Well, that's special. But you know what? It does. None of this is about belief. It's about the chemical reaction it's having to their body and what it's doing to their brain. It's not just about their belief system in the medication. And you get somebody on this for a few days and rip them off of it. That's not good. This shouldn't be... This is not wisdom that is coming into the earth from a podcaster in his basement that talks about true crime. This is just facts of medicine and how these things work. And why the fuck, you know, this has to be reiterated from this desk and it's not coming from the doctors is beyond me. It doesn't make any sense at all, other than people are covering their ass because nobody wants to be accountable for the shit work that they actually did.
Well, that's why what we're doing is important, because, you know, if you see one, there's at least 10 to 100 more of the same thing. It just
yes.
reaches a level of a psychotic break in the 1 in 1,000 chances that that happens. And and then even less chances that she winds up killing her kids with filicide because of it. It's extremely rare. It's extremely unusual, which means this stuff is hiding and people are unaware. And so here's, you know, some messaging for everyone out there. As I know, if anyone has been to a doctor, worked with a hospital system, has any kind of more than I've had a cold or a flu that I've had to go take care of, you've seen these crap shows in the healthcare system. You're not alone. It's not unique to your town. This is just one more example that went to the disaster zone that it did. But this is out there because these organizations are for profit, and they're going to maximize all they can to balance that dichotomy between profit and patient care. And when it starts getting skewed in the wrong directions towards profit, this is the kind of shit that happens.
And it's funny because we're not even really seeing a lot of arguing on this case about like denial of care or anything like that. I'm surprised, because that's usually
That's
usually what comes into place, where it's like, well, insurance isn't going to cover this or that, so you're stuck with this. This is just, well, here's what you were approved for. This is what. So that's not even part of the equation in this one, at least not on that's being brought to light on the surface here. I do wonder if there was any of that going on behind the scenes. But this is just, this is the system working as designed. And
yeah.
That there really isn't anything in this case where I look at it and go, well, they really didn't do their job there. No, they did their job to which the medical community and to which our laws require them to do it. They did check that box.
And one more thing on it too. I also, the other thing that struck me with listening to Dr. Tufts on this, it also struck me, part of it is, are we this hard up as a nation that people don't want to be doctors, that this is your senior person you're putting on important cases? Is that
1,000%.
Yeah. She's got a month experience and you're giving her a patient like this without supervision, without mentors, not because they didn't think she was willing or willing and open to it. She seemed willing and open to whatever people told her to do, because she just did what people told her to do. But there's no one there. So no one's going to psychiatry up in Massachusetts. Maybe
we don't have enough. There's not enough providers. So then you'd end up getting, and I'm not saying she was doing this, but this is where you get kind of the cattle call type atmosphere, where it ends up being, you know, okay, 17 minutes in and out the door, who's next? And, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of providers that are doing that, you know, with the best they can do and with the utmost of positive intentions, but there's only so much you can do when you are limited and when there's far more people that you need to help than there are of you to help them. Everything gets scaled back, and it is what it is. Then the company starts saying, oh gosh, well, if we can, you know, shuttle this many people through here and it seems to be working just fine, and there's a couple that go off the rails, well, we can write that off, the profit over it, and that's what you end up having have happen. I'm not saying this would happen in this case, but again, this is just indicative of our medical system. This is how this shit works, kids. I mean, and like I said, do I think the medical system really did a whole lot wrong here in this case? According to their rules and how they do it, no, I don't. Do I think do I think Lindsay was morally failed, ethically failed by the providers not really following, you know, the creed of first do no harm and truly care for your patients the way that they should be? Yeah, I think she was failed there. And I don't think it was like a personal failing of intent. It's just, this is how it works. And this is the baseline of what we're dealing with. And it's really sad.
And I want to highlight a little bit too on this. I might misspeak, so I'm going to caveat that with I might be a little off there, because here's my impression of what came into listening to Julie Paul, the midwife nurse practitioner, psychiatric nurse practitioner, the one that went right after Tufts, the one with a lot of experience. So as I understood it from her, as I'm paraphrasing this back, she became very passionate about women's health. My daughter's a labor and delivery nurse because of her passion for women's health. And so she kept ramping up all these different things she wanted to get better at for women's health. As I understand it, she formed her own company, formed her own group, her own, and that, so she created something out of her passion for that 90-minute intake that obviously wasn't being done in the standardized corporate world that that Tufts was in. So she formed her own thing. So you can really see the difference. And then what happens is, because this is going on in my own town, these smaller groups that are formed with these great humanitarian individuals that are there for the health, well-being of others get sucked up by these larger corporations and then snuffed out. So that beautiful individuality that she brought to her clients, having her cell phone, making phone calls on weekends, checking in, 90-minute intakes, gets snuffed out by the corporations that are there to make the big money.
It's true. I got one more comment, then I want to go to Murdaugh.
But
if Lindsay didn't tell the truth about Lindsay's past, how's the doctor supposed to know? They're not. This is how the two things in parallel can work together. Number one, charts should be able to be communicated from doctor to doctor. So that's it. And Tufts, I believe, is the one who said, well, Lindsay was so accurate in what she was telling me. I thought she just had it all going on, basically. Like, it's not this patient's responsibility to recite their medication list to you. That should be already charted professionally because it may not be accurate from the person suffering from psychosis. But the thought here of how are they supposed to know? If on the things that are not communicated, they're not. But here's the deal. We also have to accept that a person that can be in psychosis is not going to be delivering that information accurately. And we as a society also have to accept that that person might not be responsible then for the horrific things that they do when they're in a state of active psychosis. Because it's not gobbledygook, it's not witchcraft. These sort of things happen. And it's not that they're trying to hide something or be deceptive. Their brain is not working right. And it's rare, and that's why we can't just dole out reason of insanity, please, to everybody, but we need to look at every case individually and examine whether that happens, because it does sometimes, and this is one where it did.
Anyway, so
let's go to Alec Murdaugh.
Hold on. One more. So Tony, because it's a direct response to this. How are they supposed to know if Lindsay doesn't tell? This is where reps comes in.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. When you do an interview, and this is why Reddington brought up, if you're only doing telehealth and you can't see the entire body to see the reactions that she's having full body when she's giving her answers, someone with a lot of experience, years and years of reps, is going to be able to pick up on wobbles that we need to explore more here, because it's going to be tells that she gives off. Again, if she's witting of it, but if she doesn't know because of the psychosis, another thing. But again, reps pays in. Anyway, go ahead.
In the case of Tufts, it's just time.
No,
she doesn't have the years yet. And that's something that only time can give her. Yeah. Telehealth and time. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of things are going. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts over there. Let's go talk about another case. This is having a hearing later in the week, and we'll be covering it Friday morning. Alec Murdaugh is back in front of the new judge, Deborah McCaslin. And the paper has been flying all week. Prosecutors just filed to use his own 2023 testimony against him. Every admission read straight to the new jury. They're also asking the judge to ban any talk of another suspect and keep the polygraph evidence out entirely. I know you guys aren't confused about who you think killed Maggie and Paul. I don't think I am either. But a lot of you guys want to know whether the state's new playbook actually seals this or blows it. I understand the arguments going in here of we don't want any talk of third party. And we also want to keep things that are going into the jury to be of a certain ilk, if you will. We don't want to. There's certain things we want to add in here, like Alec's testimony about his deceptiveness, about everything he said in the first round. Will it make it in? That's what this pretrial motion is going to be all about, and we'll see where it goes. The state wants one of the questions is to read his 2023 testimony to the new jury. The I lied to investigators for a year and a half, that sort of stuff, in his own words. The listener who made the comment said, part of me is cheering. Let his mouth convict him twice. But if I'm being honest, if the judge says yes, hasn't the retrial basically already happened? I don't know. If you're letting in testimony from that previous trial, is it? Should his full testimony be played back or read back in a new trial for everyone to take in? And does it, would it, I guess, even have the same weight that it did in round one, where suddenly we learned at the last minute that Alec Murdaugh had been lying the whole time? Because we didn't know that until he went on the stand.
Right.
That element of shock and suspense is now just part of the story. It's not part of the actual, oh my God, moments in the court. I don't know, Robin, what do you think? Should the judge allow a piece of that testimony in, or that whole testimony in, to the new trial, even considering that trial was viewed to be, you know, not valid, and we gotta go.
I don't know why you wouldn't. I mean, it's just channeling my inner Bob Mata, who we love, and I learned so much about what defense does and what their whole role in these things is in upholding the Constitution and make sure it's legal and fair. And you can imagine, you know, the suppression things are going to put in there, and they're going to try to suppress everything they possibly can. But I don't know, if it was in there before, they'd have to come up with another reason to suppress it. I mean, you can see why they're not doing as much financial stuff, because that was deemed in the appeals court as too much. And I don't know why or how you'd be able to get rid of this. I think it's completely appropriate to have in there, because just because it's being retried doesn't mean you can't do the same things you did last time. That's what the defense is going to try to get rid of and toss out. But that's also what the prosecution is going to hold on to if it worked before. And you can see their whole intention behind everything. They're trying to do all they can to remove all the reasonable doubt that could be presented to the jury.
Well, I think
that's it.
I think it's about the way it's being presented to the jury. Right. It's on the record now. So if he were to go back and say, no, I wasn't down at the kennels, he'd be impeaching himself. That's on the record. That could be brought into play, which the judge may make a ruling like that of like, well, if you open the door to it, we can call you out on it. Or it may be something to the effect of, well, here's the record of what you say happened. Follow that record, that story that you've admitted you did, and we don't necessarily have to go, and by the way, he lied about it for all that time. And then finally, the play at issue is whether or not going to the jury and saying you lied about it for all of that time, when it's now just flatly on the record. So it would kind of impeach him a bit, but he's not, you know, he's not really trying to be impeached in a second trial if he just followed through and with the story.
It's more about him. It's more about presenting he lied rather than it is about the fact he was there.
Yeah.
Because that's more of an impact, saying you lied, because juries don't like when they're being lied to. So I don't know why.
He could take the stand again. That's the next question, is if his old testimony comes in either way, what does he do? Does he take the stand again to explain the first time, to explain why he lied? I mean, that's what he did in the first trial. He went up there and said, yes, I lied, and here's why. Because, oh, what a tangled web we weave, according to Alec. And then went into, when he started lying, he started telling people this, he had to keep the story going because otherwise he'd look shitty. And it was because he was on drugs, this is according to him, and this and that. And you know what? I kind of buy that might be why he lied, of why he was down there. I'm not buying that he didn't have anything to do with this, but if we're, Alec works in segments. Alec is very compartmentalized in the way he handles things. And he's talking specifically about why he lied, not about the murder, not about this, but in the context of simply the box over here of why he said he was not there. The motivation does make sense as to why he said it once and kept it going.
And you highlighted it, you know, right there. You presented the reasonable doubt. I could believe it. I mean, you said it. So, yeah. So having him, I think having him, it's a risky thing. And you know, defense attorney is never going to want their client to really testify, especially in this case. But because he can be slaughtered on cross on this, but if he can rely on that drug-induced craze, you can garner sympathy, because, you know, because I think some people will give sympathy for that if he presents properly. And I say properly, in other words, he actually means it's not part of some sort of, you know, presentation he's given like he did last time with the fake tears and the blubbering and all the crazy yucky snot pouring out of him. But it's enough that does present that reasonable doubt, because that's all it looks like from our standpoint. That's all the defense is trying to do, is give reasonable doubt so that he can't serve.
Well, I mean, that's what the civil attempt was at suing Becky Hill for the $600,000, which got thrown out this last week. Yep. So all of the depositions and all that they were going to try and do, it was essentially a fishing expedition, in my opinion, to try and find something that they could poke a hole into, because I don't know that they're ever really going to land on a third party culprit of like, it was you. And that's what we're going to talk about here in a second. But they're looking to insinuate that there might be. And that is reasonable doubt. The state has just renewed its motion to ban the jury from hearing any arguments about another suspect. They won that fight in the first trial. And obviously, you know, Becky Hill got involved and then everything went to shit. Should they have that in the second trial? Should they be banned from going down that third party culprit route, I guess, is the question. I mean, unless you got a third party culprit, you know, there's ways of insinuating it. I mean, we saw it in the Karen Reed trial a while back, where it was insinuating that the officers, you know, did it without directly saying this specific person did this and then that person. It's just more of the idea that there was a conspiracy. Could they pitch that in this case and make a jury believe that there's something else going on behind the secretive curtains of Moselle or back in the woods, Robin?
I think they could. I think it's relatively easy if it's allowed to have happen. And that is, and you've interviewed her numerous times, and that's the housekeeper.
Yeah.
So the first thing that enters my mind, again, is I always take that behavior arc. I look at human behavior before all else, because that'll start giving me filters and areas to focus on. And I said it's the beginning of the segment. That is, when you talk to and listen to the housekeeper and other people in his life, but you start there first, you call her on the stand, she'll testify, I'm sure, again, and you ask a simple question. Has Alex ever done anything for himself?
Mm-hmm.
Does he ever cook his own meals? Does he ever do his own laundry? Does he ever, literally, what does he ever do for himself? And so you then have her respond, which is, no, I did everything in the house. He was this lazy. He did this, he did this, he did this, according to what she said on your show and other places. So you're like, all right, so he never does anything for himself. And then you talk about all the other crazy things with attempted murders or stage murders for insurance claims and everything, which required another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And you just let it lie. That's what I would do, because right there, just by asking those questions, you're leaving reasonable doubt for someone. Well, he's never done anything on his own and taking care of his own problems himself. He always hires someone to take care of his own problems. So if they're allowed to bring it in, that's one thing I would definitely introduce, because you don't have to name anyone. You're just saying the dude can't do anything for himself. I don't know.
I would say Blanca Simpson could honestly one of the strongest witnesses for the defense of Alec Murdaugh. I know she doesn't believe that Alec Murdaugh, you know, is scot-free on this or didn't do it, but she has presented, I think, ample. Interesting angles to the story of what she witnessed that day, of a mysterious truck driving around the property that she couldn't identify, and nobody seems to really know who it was. There's several things that she has brought up on this show about that day on that property leading up to the murders that were out of character, out of tune, and just didn't really make a lot of sense, that have never really been answered or never really investigated either.
Yeah.
And I think you combine that with whatever you can pull out of Sled's investigation or lack thereof, all the missteps there, the not crossing of T's or dotting of I's, you find all of those areas, and you suddenly start to have a bit of a of a pool over here of stuff that just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And with the right answers, it might. Well, there's context here. Okay, that truck makes sense. It was this or that. You've put this over here. Oh, okay. Well, that makes some more sense too. But until you have that, it's Mad Libs. It's filling in the blank, and it's people guessing. This is where the conspiracy theories start up. Eddie Smith, his friend, Cousin Eddie, in this right. case, I've had his attorney on the show too. By the own admission of Murdaugh's own attorneys, allegedly once claimed that Smith failed a polygraph when he was asked about the murders. I'm not saying he did anything, and he has always denied it. He sat down for many interviews, many documentaries. He's talked about his experience there. I don't know. I mean, from everything I've seen of him, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm not here to say either way. But according to him, he had nothing to do with it. But I don't know. That's kind of a big thing to try and get admitted. And they're trying to keep this out as well. The Eddie Smith information, the polygraph evidence, they want that banned. They don't want a jury hearing that there was the guy that Alec later tried to convince to kill him for insurance money for his son, failed the polygraph about the actual murders. I don't know. That might make a jury go, reasonable doubt.
Yeah, it would. And I got lots of issues with the polygraph anyway.
So here's
how complicated the polygraph can be. Because if you don't understand, because again, I understand why they want to outlaw it from the jury, because unless you truly understand what the polygraph is, isn't, and the variability of the outcome of it, it's going to weigh very heavily, because the jury is going to say, well, he failed the polygraph, boom, you know, because they're going to take it as face value. Meanwhile, in reality, what could have triggered a reading of deception? So place yourself in a situation. So the polygraph measures physiological and emotional responses to stimulus. In other words, questions. And so it depends on what you as an individual think of that question gives your body's response to that question that the machine is reading. That's why they can say it's a truth detector. Not really. It's what it is. It's a biodetector. It registers differences in your biological makeup, you know, sweat glands, heartbeat, breathing rate, all these different sensors it has on you. It's going to register change. In other words, it's a super wobble detector. And when we hear something that's distressing in some way, our body wobbles. And so, for example, in this case, if he's asked the question, so what I would do is I would have asked a few other questions in there besides the one I saw, the ones they were asked. It was very specific towards the murder that day. The murders that day, and he wobbled on those questions, in other words, indicating deception. Now, granted, I'm not a licensed polygrapher. I just know a lot of them, and I know the process. What I would have added on there, since we know, I believe I know, that he was involved with the potential insurance fraud scheme of shooting him and everything, right?
Or he was at least tried to be roped in by Alec.
Right, so I would ask him questions about that, to do a comparison contrast, because in other words, he might have been thinking about all the other misdeeds he was doing when asked that question, and he'd have the same sort of response. So I would want to ask other questions. I know, because they're called control questions, you want to ask a lot of other questions of equal weight of things you do know that were at equal weight of potentially super fraud, like killing someone or attempting to kill someone or insurance fraud, to kind of see where they register on that physiological response to that stimulus before I came to a conclusion. Grant, I'm not criticizing a polygrapher. I don't know what the context of it. Yeah. I'm just saying that's how complicated a polygraph can be. And to explain all that to a jury, it's easier for them to say he failed.
Which is why oftentimes you're not admissible in court.
Exactly.
There is a very good argument there as to why his answers showed a wobble, because God knows what else he was involved in with Alec Murdaugh.
It's why we never polygraphed Russians, because they lie about everything. So they flatline. They show, and when I say Russians, in general, Russian intelligence officers, you know, when we're dealing with the spies, because when you believe the shit come out of your mouth, you don't look like you're lying.
Yeah, yeah. Your thoughts, that's what the prosecution wants to bring in. We're going to talk about the defense here in just a second. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation about Alec Murdaugh. Now the other side, the other stack. Last week, the defense filed a demand that prosecutors go back over everything, every file, every deal, every disciplinary record on every witness and certify in writing within 30 days that nothing was held back this time. Days before that, they moved to stop SLED from touching the DNA under Maggie's fingernails because one more state test could erase it forever. Nobody in our comments thinks Alec Murdaugh is innocent. What they think is that the people who caught him keep handing him the keys. That happens
yep.
a lot. The defense is demanding prosecutors swear in writing that they searched everything and turned it all over. 30 days signed. And here's where that lands. Last year, text messages between Alec and Eddie Smith surfaced that the defense says they never got before the first trial. Harpootlin said those texts might have changed their whole strategy. So now the murderer's lawyers, or alleged murderer's lawyers, are demanding receipts from the prosecutors. And it sounds reasonable. What does that tell you? That's the question that we got. With Eddie Smith and getting this this information, that they handle these things over in writing, what does it tell me? It tells me that they're going to try and impeach anyone that goes on that stand who's going to tell a different story than what they're going to swear to right now. So basically, they're saying to the prosecution, you need to lock down right now any road you plan on going down here in terms of this evidence, so there's no surprises in court. And if we find something, and I do wonder this, I wonder if Harpootlin knows about some of the things that maybe being held back by the state, and if they continue to hold it back, it may fly up in court suddenly one day going, oh, by the way, we have this. What do you mean you have this? We didn't turn that over. You were supposed to, and now we have it, and you didn't do that. Why didn't you do that? In a way to impeach. There's a lot of things here. I mean, at the end of the day, this is how discovery works. Both mm-hmm. sides need to play their part. Both sides need to play fair if we're going to get anywhere with this. The last thing we want is, you know, the third Alec Murdaugh trial in five more years. We want to get this thing done and done fair. And even Alec Murdaugh deserves a fair trial. Hence why we're even here right now. Yeah. Becky Hill is the reason we're here. We thought he had a fair trial until she stuck her hands in the honey jar.
Remarkable, isn't it?
So what are they trying to do? I mean, they're trying to find places to poke holes. And they have every right to do so because that's how the defense works.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm saying these things or recognizing the importance of doing these things until I just listened to Bob Mata so much. I mean,
yeah.
Really, you know, and I'll give him a pump even because it's Tuesdays with Bob, and Bob is actually covering the Lindsey Clancy case.
He's in person
for us. Yeah, so he's in it for us. But I'm going to bring the attention to the Gacy thing, Buried, his podcast on Buried, which is the Gacy case. He does an amazing job. It's why I understand what the defense is doing here of, and I'm going to put it in my layman terms of what defense attorneys do. The real job of defense attorneys is not to find their client innocent. Their job is to make sure the Constitution and the law is being upheld. Because mm-hmm. without defense attorneys, without these people, without Murdaugh's defense attorneys doing this, you could have a lot of shoddy work. You could have a lot of railroading. Again, if you put Murdaugh as a suspect aside, this is why defense attorneys exist. They exist to uphold the Constitution, the rights, the protections that our first, was it, Sixth Amendments give us, the Bill of Rights. That's why they're in place, not to find people innocent, but to make sure the system is working the way it was intended to work for fair and equal justice. Otherwise, welcome to the world of Judge Dredd. And that's exactly why they exist. And so watching and listening, as frustrating as it is, because like you said, everyone believes he's guilty, that's not enough because that's not the legal process. And so his lawyers are doing what they do mm-hmm. to make sure SLEDs did their job properly, to make sure that everyone, that's what their job is. Their job is to make sure everyone did exactly what they're meant to do within the legal bounds of what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights grants every single U.S. person. So I get it, as frustrating as it is.
Well, and the thing, people like to be very selective about when they want to be on the side of the investigators and when they don't want to be on the side of the investigators. And it's always very much on who you think is the shittier person. And in this case, Alec Murdaugh usually wins that competition. But the reality, though, is just this last spring, a judge threw out a whole different indictment, not connected to the Murdaugh case, but connected to SLED with the same investigators on the Murdaugh case, the Colucci case. Look it up, because evidence that could have helped the defense never got turned over. So this very thing that we've been talking about of why is it important to turn all these things over? Because if you don't, here's what can happen. The same system, same era, same problem. This is not ancient history. That was this spring. That was a few months ago. So that is one of the big reasons that Murdaugh's attorneys are citing for the demand, 30 days, give us everything you got, turn it all over, because we're not going to screw around with you and the games that you already appear to have been playing in other cases. If you have a department that's doing that with one case, you can sure as shit bet they're probably doing it on others. It's not usually an isolated incident.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as the great Bob Mata says, just do the work. And
yeah.
And so I said, you know, I know we didn't talk about it today, but we did before the show. You know, it's why cases like the Nancy Guthrie case terrify me if they actually get the guy that they think is a suspect. And not because of anything else, that I pray to God that the investigators aren't disheveled and disorganized and as haphazard as Nanos has been on air. Because if they are, whoever it is they get, they got a high probability of walking because discovery, they're going to be able to squash all the suppressions they're going to maybe do because of how the case may have been handled. Again, if you're looking for how things are handled at the top, if it filtered down, that's a potential disaster. That's why when you are assigned these positions, you really do due diligence. That's why I hated doing evidence response team stuff, because the precision, the accuracy, the chain of custody, the gloves, the every single document. I mean, the work you had to do on evidence response for just these purposes is beyond my 50,000 foot brain. This is at the granular level, and I do not operate well at the granular level. That's why you got to dot the I's and cross the T's, because otherwise it can be deemed unconstitutional and defense will have it thrown out. And then you wasted a lot. Think about the amount of wasted time that could be done and the injustice that is done and a guilty man walks if they don't do it the right way. And conversely as well.
Well, I would love to know, honestly, if other people are involved in this. I mean, everybody wants to crucify Alec Murdaugh, and I think there's plenty of crucifying that is well-deserved there. But I have always wondered if there is someone else involved, and not that he isn't involved, but whoever else might be involved should probably also be prosecuted, if they exist. And I don't have a clear path to say, yes, I think that's for sure. I maybe like 20-30% thinking there might be somebody else involved. I'm like 70-80 that it was 100, that it was him. 70-80 that it was 100% him. 70-80% him, maybe 20-30 somebody else. I don't know. The DNA fight is the one that a lot of people are talking about, because when you sample DNA material, it runs through testing. I'm not a DNA tester. I don't do it as a side hustle, but I know there's only so much DNA you can test. It's not like, oh, it's here and everybody can go test it their own way. No, everybody gets there. It's a limited amount of the cookie that everyone gets, and eventually you're out of crumbs. And they're down to the last smidgen of crumb, basically. And the state wants to test the DNA under her fingernail again. The defense is saying, wait a second, we should probably do that too. You've already tested it once, and this is where you got, or you didn't test it correctly. So we want to run it as well. Where that could possibly lead, and it might lead absolutely nowhere. This could be a big nothing burger for the defense, where it's like, well, it's inconclusive, or it turns out to be very explainable in some way, shape, or form. But DNA under a fingernail, I mean, it's not hard to get someone else's DNA under your fingernail if, oh, I don't know, say you go shopping and you pick up an item at the store. I mean, it is transferable. It's mm-hmm. it's very easily gotten from non-nefarious means. But wouldn't it be interesting if you could name whose DNA was under Maggie's fingernail, and what a story that would tell, especially if it's someone identifiable within the circle of World Murdaugh.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, why wouldn't you have evidence included? I mean, it makes no sense to me why you wouldn't for prosecution or defense. I mean, it's there. It raises questions, and you have to flush those out. You know, when we talk about all these cases, you know, the Murdaugh case as well as the Guthrie case, Nolan Wells. All these cases, you cover every single lead you get, and you flush it out until you determine what it is, what it isn't, and then you include it. And so we have DNA under a fingernail. Yeah, you got to include it. I don't know why you wouldn't have it tested.
You know, I think a question everyone needs to ask themselves about any case that they look at, if they truly want justice, if you're arguing not to test something to its fullest extent or to go down the lane to get the answer when it is achievable to get, and you don't want to go there, you don't want whatever side to go there to find it, what is your reasoning as to why you don't want them to get there? If it's just an absolute answer that can be achieved, what is the motivation to not get there? And if it's because, well, that might disagree with the way you think the case should go or the conclusion you want, then your motivation's not pure. You're not interested in justice. You're interested in your side winning, in your conjecture being correct. And when it comes to justice, it's not about that. It's about getting to the truth. And that's what is lost so many times in these cases.
Critical thinking.
Yeah. And that's what we need a bit more of these days. So there you go. We'll cover the hearing on Friday, and you'll get updates on all of that. And we'll see where it goes, because there's going to be some critical things decided here on Friday. Maybe not quite decided, but argued Friday. And then we'll see how long it takes McCaslin to make a ruling. Sometimes that can be days, weeks, who knows. But it will really set the stage for what this trial is going to look like 8 months from now, if we hit that date. I still think it could be pushed out, but who knows? We'll find out. We will love a spring of Alec Murdaugh. Get your Alec Murdaugh Easter decorations. I'm personally going to do Easter eggs this year with Alec's picture on the side of the eggs.
I can't wait to see the AI stuff you produce with that.
It's going
to
be great. The Murdaugh bunny will be coming. And,
the Murdaugh bunny. Yeah, the slobbery Murdaugh bunny.
Snot dripping down.
Yes.
Nobody wants
great.
To sit
All
in his lap.
Eggs.
Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube on the Murdaugh case and everything we're talking there about here. We're looking forward to that. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books and audiobook. Leave a review on Apple, or leave a review rather on Amazon. Greatly appreciated there. All right. Until next time, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, Lady Luck?
Bretsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.